yeah, it's a huge disconnect, right? There's so much buzz. And then I think those stats are probably completely correct. I'd fully believe that 95% of pilots are failing, but I would question, what is a pilot? I'm Fraser Payne, head of AI with HSO. The following is a conversation between myself and Nathan Bregman, our marketing lead, on AI agents. What are they, and why are 95% of AI pilots failing according to MIT? We discuss the anatomy of agents, the three T's, tasks, tools, and triggers, and the different levels of agency that we see in AI agent solutions. We also talk about the adoption strategies that organizations can employ to avoid becoming another statistic, and some parting words for the CIOs and CTOs among you who might be interested in adopting AI agents in your own organizations. As this is the first episode in this series, we would really love any feedback that you might be able to provide us. And I just really hope you enjoy the episode. Thanks.
So I feel like I've heard the word agent about 50 times a week for the last year. And while I feel I've got a fairly good idea what it is about, no one seems to be quite sure what an agent actually means. Do you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, it's certainly lacking a concrete definition. Some people get pretty opinionated about it and kind of gatekeep it. I think it's easier just to look at how we're already using the word. So if you think about, you know, we've got customer services agents, we've got travel agents, we've got secret agents of the FBI and the CIA. Mm-hmm. They're all people who do a task, who express agency, who do something. And I think that translates really well to how we're using AI today anyway. The simplest agents are like a chatbot that maybe goes away and finds something for you. It takes a few steps in its search. Mm-hmm. And so people are kind of calling this agentic search, but really it's just a chatbot and it's just chatting to your data. And then there are agents that do something for you, that actually complete a task. And these are a little bit more like a travel agent or a real estate agent who provide a simple interface to a complex system. So they make something that would take a lot of dials and knobs and tuning, and they turn that into, you know, you ask it simply to do this thing for you. On the furthest end of the spectrum, right, those secret agents, the FBI agents and so forth, we don't really have an equivalent to that these days. People will point to some of these coding agents that go away and do really complex tasks, but they don't decide when to do the coding task. You know, something that would get closer to that level three agency would be a system that maybe, you know, monitors your code repo and it looks at requests for new features and then it proposes them and it writes up the code and it puts forward, you know, a pull request to say, hey, add this new feature to your code. I've already written it for you and it passes all the test cases. That would be getting into that kind of level three agency. So we actually propose this kind of level system of saying a level one agent is simple call and response or singular actions that are quite hard coded. Mm-hmm. A level two agent is a simple interface to a somewhat complex system. It might write a document for you or complete a task. And a level three agent orchestrates when it does those tasks. It makes decisions. It defines its own tools maybe. It goes out and finds information in your system kind of autonomously.
Right. So there's various different types of agents. They're all agents, but they have a different level of agency, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
From a travel agent, which kind of just does a task, to a secret agent, which kind of does whatever they want to get the job done. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah. Yeah. If they have a license to kill, I guess they do whatever they want. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A 00 agent.
Yeah.
So should we rename it from a level three agent to a 00 agent?
I think that'll be maybe next year.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll come up with that.
It sounds like there's some pretty core pieces or puzzle pieces in these agents. What are the core building blocks that kind of make up different agents and how do they differ?
Yeah, I think there are many different components and it's as varied as humans are in that we all have the same anatomy. We all have the same arms, legs and head, but how we use them is completely different, right? Between a tradesman or a builder versus someone who works in code for a living or makes sales. I think the kind of transfer there to agents would be that they have three T's that we often talk about. So they have tasks, tools, and triggers. Tasks as a specification of what it is that they're doing, how they do it, what kind of decisions they make or steps that they take. The tools are the means by which they complete the task. So if they read your email, if they do a search on your database, if they write out a new record to a CRM, et cetera. And then the triggers are the conditions under which they take those tasks or they execute those tasks. So the three kind of feed into one another, where a trigger would start off a task would use a tool, and in some cases, you know, a tool call from one agent might be the trigger for another agent. So there's a way in which these kind of all interplay with one another. I think the triggers are actually, in a way, the simplest but also the most interesting thing. At the moment, triggers are just when you ask it to do something, right? In a chatbot context, you just ask it to find the information. That's the trigger. What's becoming more interesting is these kind of dynamic triggers where you might have an agent, for example. I have an agent that monitors my email inbox, and it's kind of a second level spam filter. I don't like the quality of filtering I get in my junk folder. Sometimes things that aren't junk wind up there, and inversely, a lot of things that are junk wind up in my inbox. So instead, I have an agent that now filters, and I check my priority box that the agent curates for me, and then I check my lower priority boxes kind of as I have more time in the day. And this is filtering, you know, on average, like 180 emails that I don't want to read into a true junk folder that were previously making it into my inbox. And I have complete controllability and steerability of that agent. I can update its instructions if it's filtering incorrectly. So there's, yeah, I think these very small things that are just huge quality of life increases.
Cool. In practical terms, what does it take to go from like a simple agent to a more complex agent that's doing tasks by itself? So I think you call it a level three agent.
Yeah, I mean, so I think first you need to go from level one to level two, but certainly it's the same type of steps that you're taking. So in a level one agent, it might be just doing call and response. It's kind of just retrieving information, or it's executing a very simple tool. Those basic level one agents become the foundation of a level two agent. So the knowledge that you embed in a chatbot, for example, would become the knowledge base that level two agent would reference when it's drafting a document for you. It would use that same knowledge base. So establishing those components, establishing the tools, for example, in a level one agent would mean that level two agent, it may have a more advanced task that's more automated, or it might be triggered by more dynamic triggers, but it's using the same tools. So it's really, you can kind of step up that maturity curve in each of those three domains. You can have more advanced tasks, more advanced tools, more advanced triggers. And incrementally, your system or your agent becomes more and more autonomous, more and more agentic. And that naturally leads towards that level three kind of full agency picture.
So a lot of organizations are taking a stab at implementing agents these days. It's the buzz around town. Everyone wants a piece of it,
yeah,
whether they're sure what they are or not.
Yeah.
But a lot of them fail. I think I saw MIT said 95% of agent applications fail, and yeah, software engineers everywhere are raving about the productivity they're getting in their workflow. What's going on here? What's your take here?
Yeah, it's a huge disconnect, right? There's so much buzz, and then I think those stats are probably completely correct. Like, I wouldn't challenge them at all. I'd fully believe that 95% of pilots are failing, but I would question, what is a pilot? And I think when you dig into that report, it's actually a really interesting report. It's totally public. And worth reading. A lot of what was qualified there as a pilot was really people adopting, you know, Copilot Studio, sticking 10 documents into it and saying, this is our new HR bot. And then people are like, well, great, it has those 10 policy statements, but it doesn't have these other 15. Or when I ask it about our travel policy, it quotes me the policy from 5 years ago. It was updated 2 years ago. And so that they're lacking kind of data curation, you know, to have the correct policy referenced. Or they're lacking prompt fine-tuning because it's not being set up by an ML engineer, or they're not iterating on that or instructing people to go and use it. So even though the tool's out there, even if it's performing quite well, there's a lack of adoption. And in fact, the number one issue when ranked as to the failure cases of these pilots was lack of adoption. So change management around the tool usage. And I think that's a huge disconnect. I think that the other more interesting point, and you raised like really, really interesting point that you raised, is that software engineers are having such a great time, and everyone else is like, well, this stuff's useful, but it's kind of like, it's speeding up 1 to 2 tasks a day. It's not automating my job. And the difference I would say is that software engineers are the ones making the software, right? So they know exactly what their job looks like. They can write a really good agent because they're intimately familiar with how the AI behaves. They're intimately familiar with their own job, and they can marry the two right down into the detail of what's reasoning steps do I take when I'm doing a coding task? What tools do I interface with? How do I find parts of my code base? Like, how do I run grep commands to get a section of my code base or find the relevant functions that are being called? You know, like these hierarchical decision-making things.
So they have an intimate understanding of the problem they're trying to solve and what that process is. And so they're able to instruct the agents and give them the context they need.
Exactly. And I think what we'll see is that we're in kind of the very first innings of AI being applied to other jobs, whereas we see more people who are kind of AI native in the workforce. And I think this is a really interesting place for new grads today that are having a hard time in the labor market, is to be really good in a niche domain that's not software, mm-hmm. right? But if you've gotten a CS degree and you're having a hard time getting a job, go and get a secondary skill and apply AI to that secondary mm-hmm. skill, right? Get really good at law, get really good at biology, get really good at administrative processes, get a boring job in a call center, and then see every case that you could apply AI to that call center job. And, you know, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of people who are trying to automate and improve the quality of life and the flow and the efficiency of call centers today. So there's going to be this wealth of optimization opportunity that at the moment, only software engineers are really realizing that full benefit.
Yeah. Right. And so to get the most out of agents, you need to marry up those two expertise of the subject matter of the thing you're trying to automate, and also knowing how to program these agents.
Yeah. And the middle ground, the short-term way that you can kind of address this is what I tell a lot of our clients is to not buy AI, right? Don't buy AI. Mm-hmm. You should hire it. So actually, the first time you turn the agent on and you go live in the pilot, consider that day one for the agent. It's gotten onboarding. It's gotten introduced to the onboarding documents. It's gotten the basic instruction, the first pass of a prompt on what to do. Mm-hmm. It's as dumb as it can possibly be, right? It's literally the worst it could ever be at that job. And so what you want to do is get extremely critical feedback in that first week, just like you go back and forth and you adjust someone's behavior on the job, or they get to watch someone, or they have a buddy, or they shadow someone in their first 2 weeks. You get that round of iteration and you bake that into the way that you deliver the project. So actually your pilot is step one, and then you have like a 0.1, a 0.2, a 0.3 that are maybe 2 week sprints of iteration where you're capturing feedback, you're looking at usage logs, you're understanding failure cases, you're, you know, addressing bugs, you're improving the knowledge base, the reference set, the information being referenced by the agent, and you keep climbing this hill. And oftentimes we've seen on evaluations, and it's critical to have good evaluations for these systems, you go from 60 to 65, 70, you have some big unlock, you might jump up to 80. And then for you know, 85 to 90% of queries, people are happy with the response they're getting. That's relatively productive, right? That's a pretty useful tool, even if it's not 100%. It's trending in that direction. And as a new model comes out, a GPT-5, 5.5, 6, whatever comes out next, you can kind of plug and play that new model in and get that unlock and get that advancement in your solution.
It's cool. It's all great context and ways to think about this. As far as actionable takeaways for CTOs or CIOs who might be looking to implement agents, what advice do you have there?
So not to turn that one around on you too much, but I think so CIOs, CTOs are the key stakeholder or the owner of these things, but they do need to play a product owner role. Right? The customer is the COO and you need them in that conversation. So I think that the thing I would actually stress most to a CTO or a CIO is go talk to the COO and actually have that meeting instead of talking to vendors necessarily. Really understand what is the problem you're solving today? What is the current workflow? What are the change management barriers to introducing this new process?
Right. So that comes back to that marrying the operations with the expertise. A CTO, CIO, knows that the technical domain, but might not necessarily understand the problem he's trying to solve in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. No, and beyond that as well, it's not just not understanding the problem, but not understanding the culture that you're pushing it into. So if you come in and say, hey, you know, I'm you know, the smart engineer here and I've automated your job, and then they introduce a tool and it's wrong in some way, you haven't involved them in the conversation, you're just going to piss them off. Right. Mm. And then all you've done is really annoy the COO. And all of their reports, and that they're saying like, well, this thing's wrong 10% of the time. And even though you've spent, you know, a few $100,000 engineering this 90% accurate solution, they see it's wrong 10% of the time. They say that's unacceptable, and now it's one of the failed pilots in the 95%.
Yeah. Cool. So that's kind of the state of where things are now. If you were to look forward 12, 18 months to the future, what do you think will have changed around agents and the way we're using them or see them or et cetera, et cetera?
Yes. Well, this is where I get to be wrong live on camera. I'm not going to make accurate predictions 12 to 18 months out, but I do think there's some obvious trends. I do think we're seeing what is quite interesting is as kind of some people see it as a plateau in progress of these AI models. I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. I think that we all like the scaling laws that people talk about, if you've heard of scaling laws in AI, is that you see linear returns on a log graph. And not to get into the maths of that, but it basically means if you want to increase, you know, performance by 2x, say, you might need to increase the spend by 10x. So you need to actually spend a lot more than you see in gains. And when you plot that on a non-log graph, what that actually looks like is something that really steeply curves off and flatlines. Is what that looks like. And you can keep it going linear if you just keep 10xing the amount of spend. And you can spend 10 billion on something, but when you try to spend 100 billion, you turn a few more heads. Mm-hmm. And the next year when you want to spend a trillion, you know, then people are really start to question things. So we can probably keep scaling these systems up. And I think we will see them scale up for another 12 to 16 months. But I think the more interesting thing is actually going to be not generalizing so much and trying to be the oracle of everything that these models have been in the past. And we're going to see a lot more domain-specific models. So if you limit the scope of what it needs to be intelligent at, you know, by 100x, make it way more narrow down to just, you know, I want a system, for example, I want this. This is an open call to you model providers out there. I would really love to see a model that's incredibly performant at writing professional documents. It doesn't need to be a creative writing agent, doesn't need to be a maths agent or a coding agent, but writes really well-structured documents for, you know, RFPs, for statements of work, for contractual agreements, that can kind of analyze clauses, that can follow the tone of a document and write in that same structured approach, and then just output super clean markdown that I can stick into a Word document.
Right. Well, that would be a matter of fine-tuning existing models, or how would one go about?
Yeah, I think so. You could do a fine tune, and that would be a reasonable starting point. I think the really interesting thing here is there's two problems, right? And they're both related to data. So one is that a lot of the best documents for this, the professional documents that you want to have in your training data set, they're not on the public internet inherently, right? That private contract, they're really, you know, they're absolutely not going to be available to you and me searching on Google. So they're not being scraped by these big model companies to feed into their data sets. The second issue is that when you don't have access to huge volumes of data, what you want to use is synthetic data. And synthetic data is really good in verifiable domains. So that's basically maths and code. There's other verifiable domains if you get more kind of into the weeds of it, but realistically, it's code that compiles and passes certain test cases, or maths where you can kind of verify the proof using some proof-solving system. So either of those are great. But everything outside of that domain is challenged, right? So this is, again, why we're seeing really great progress. We're getting like Maths Olympiad gold coming out of OpenAI and Google. We're seeing, you know, Cursor get incrementally better at software engineering and all of these gains. But we're not seeing as much progress in just like, write this basic document for me. You know, an intern could have done a better job in a lot of cases than even GPT-5. It's an improvement, I'll say, but it's, you know, it's worse than GPT-4.5 was a year ago. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, cool. This is all great. Do you have any parting words of advice or resources that listeners can go to if they want to check out more or learn more?
Yeah, it's a fast moving field. So I think, you know, whenever you listen to this, the world will be different, I'd imagine. You can always come and talk to us, I'd say. We do love to have these conversations and hear about the different challenges that people are facing. And actually, more interestingly than challenges is, how are you already using AI today? And if you go out and you talk to your employees or your staff or your customers and actually ask them, you know, what are their usage patterns like, you can often find some really interesting insights around, you know, where they're at today. And there's actually a whole philosophy around this called desire paths. Mm-hmm. So desire paths are, if you look at the way that people walk across a field, they kind of carve out the path they wish exists. And if you pave that for them, then they stop treading on your lovely lawn. So I think listening to your employees, finding their desire paths, how they wish they were using AI, and then you build tools around that streamline that experience, is a great place to start. And for everything else, you know, come have a conversation with us.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks for your time, Fraser. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Cheers, Evan.